This is HPR episode 2948 entitled, Testing with Haskell, and is part of the series, Haskell. It is hosted by Tuku Toroto, and is about 43 minutes long, and carries a clean flag. The summary is, Introduction on HSpec, and Quick Check.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hello, you're listening to the Hacker Public Radio and this is Tuturto. This time I'm going to talk about a little bit about testing and Haskell. So testing is a software testing that is a really big domain. There's lots of things to test and lots of different kinds of tests and lots of different kinds of approaches to testing. And it's something dear and near to my heart. I did my master's thesis about this, for example. But today I'm going to focus on automated testing usually done by developers and even very small part of it. So a couple of reasons for testing, like I'm going to explain next, is that first of all, you can check that your code works now and at later point of time, and it also helps you to clarify your thoughts when you're writing those tests. You have to think about what you are writing from a little bit different point of view. And it also gives you a nice executable specification. Like anyone reading those tests can try and figure out how the software is supposed to work, because those tests are there for that reason. The tools I'm going to use this time are HSpec and QuickCheck. So HSpec is an automated test. It's a testing framework. It has an automatic test detection. So if you have your tests in a correct directory named in a correct way, it will detect them for you, and then it can run those. And it allows you to specify hierarchy. So you can have for example, you can have some feature, and under that feature you can have tests, and then you get a report when the tool is run. You get a nice report that shows that for this feature these tests were run. And you also get a report that these are tests that were run, and these were all the results of the each and test, and in the end of the test run you get also a list of tests that failed. So I'm trying to avoid talking about code too much, but if you have access to the show notes, now would be a good time to have a quick glance at them. So in the HSpec, to specify a pile of tests, you create a function called spec that has a type of spec, and inside of that function you just write basically like describe very important feature, do it, execution should be error free, do, and then the test part, and then next test comes it, flux capacitors can be charged, and the testing code, and then you will start a next feature, like describe somewhat less important feature. So you have a nice domain specific language for writing out the test case structure. And quick check I'm going to talk a little bit later. That's a really, really cool tool. I'm going to talk about it during this episode, but now we focus on the HSpec a little bit. Unit tests, these are basically the smallest tests you can write as the name implies, state is a unit. Unit is of course a very abstract concept, but it's a something not too big. And these are written as a using the HVAC, I usually write these as a single example. So there's a single case that I have a, for example, I have some specific function. When I give it a certain parameters, I get a certain answer, and the test verifies that. And for the different case, I have different tests. So these are really small, and they test one point in the parameter space. So in the show notes, I have a example about testing those Markov chains that I wrote not too long ago, and there's a two tests. So first is it adding new starting element to empty configuration creates item fit with frequency of 1. So when we have an empty configuration and we add starting element there, we should get a configuration where that starting element has a frequency of 1. And this is written as a config equals add start AA empty config. So we are adding an AA to the empty config, and we are getting a new, and that creates us a new config. And then we are just verifying it. I'm in the code, I'm using lenses. I haven't talked about these much, but these are basically just a way of reading and modifying a nested data structures. So then I'm checking the value as a config. This is the config that we just created. Config starts dot head dot item frequency should be just 1. So we are taking the config, we are going to the starting elements, we are taking the first element with the head, and then we are taking from that element, we are taking the frequency, and it should be 1. That's it. And then the next one is the config. Config starts head item just should be just AA. So same thing, but instead of frequency, we are grabbing the actual element, and that should be the AA. That's the one we added. And that's our test. This verifies that when we have an empty configuration, we add one element there as a starting element, it should be added there, and it should have a frequency of 1. Simple as that. And the next example is the a little bit more complicated. It reads as it adding same element twice to empty configuration creates item with frequency of 2. Basically the same thing, but now that we are adding it twice, it should have weight of twice, weight of frequency. Same thing, we are starting with the empty configuration. We say just say config equals add start AA dollar add start AA empty config. So we take an empty configuration, add AA there, that creates us a new configuration, and add AA there again as a starting element. And this is our data that now we are verifying. And then there's the same check as earlier. The first item there in the starting element should be AA, but this time it should have a frequency of 2. Simple as that. Okay, and really briefly about those lenses. So that, for example, if we have a, now I'm going to read it verbatim. If we have a this config grave question mark open parent config starts l dot underscore head dot item l dot underscore just close parent should be just AA. So what this actually really means is that we are starting with the config, and then we are applying a lens that produces a maybe. That's why we are using the grave question mark to apply that. We are going to read from that value, or we are going to read the value that this lens produces. We could also modify that value. We could just say that we are going to change this value, but now we are reading, hence grave question mark. Config starts L is a lens that focuses on the starting element of in the config, which is a list. underscore head, we are composing that with a dot operator. So we are taking out one lens and putting another lens after it. Underscore head takes the first element of the list. Item L is a lens that takes the element part from that element, the item part. Like, remember that in those starting elements have a frequency and the and then the actual element. So this lens focuses to that item part, and it is a maybe type. So then we use the underscore just to focus on the just side. So now we have maybe text as a result. When we use this lens that we just built out of smaller lenses and used that grave question mark to read the value, we are going to get just AA back. Okay, so that's how the lenses work in this example. There are a lot more than you can do, but that's enough for us to do now. So back to the tests. So we had these two unit tests that checked that the adding starting elements work as intended, or some specific cases work as intended. If we really wanted to check the code more thoroughly, we would have a lot more tests. Like, we would also check that if we add AA and BB as starting element, both of those would be present as a starting element with frequency of 1, and adding AA and BB, and BB would result AA being present with a frequency of 1 and BB being present with a frequency of 2, and so on. So there's because this test only focuses on a single point in the parameter space. So I like unit tests. They're easy enough to write usually. And if they are not easy to write, that might mean that I don't really understand what I'm doing. Like, if I cannot really write down what the code should be doing, how can I write code that actually does that part? So as I said, they verify one specific case. They are usually very fast to run because they are not reaching out and touching to the database or talking over network or doing things like that. They're usually really fast to run. And I don't always write these before writing the code, but sometimes I do. Sometimes it's really helpful to just sit and think that what kind of function signature I would want, and how would I want to use this specific thing that I'm going to write next. So you are kind of starting from the point of view of the user of the function, and then you're first writing down how you're going to use it, and then you're going to write the implementation. So as I said, this test only a very specific case, single point. And if you wanted to test a bigger case, you would have to write a lot of tests, or you can do property-based tests, which is what I'm going to talk about next. This, as the name implies, are testing that a property holds for a function with a generated parameters. Property meaning that the function specific feature or property of the output of the function is the always present there when you are calling it with some random set of parameters. So in the code, these look a little bit shorter. So again in the show notes, there's a two tests. These are from the game again. These are about food production. So it says describe planets to describe food to eat. Food requirement for positive amount of population is more than 0. And then for all positive population, lambda food requirement is greater than raw resource 0. So this means that if you have any population on a planet, one or more, then they are going to require some food. That's basically what it's saying. So if you have anything, any population present, they are going to, their food requirement is going to be greater than zero. Apparently, I don't have robots in my game. And the next one is food-based production for farms is equal or greater than the amount. And this is for all farms, lambda. Some FMAT food-based production is greater than raw resource of length X. Meaning that if you have some amount of farms and you calculate all and you calculate the total food-based production, that is going to be greater than the amount of farms. So essentially every farm is going to produce at least two units of biological resources. So how does this work? I'll focus on the first case, that for all positive population, lambda X food requirement is greater than zero. So positive population here is a generator. I have written them down in the show notes. And positive population has a type of gen list of planet population, so it can generate a list of planet population. And it's written as a k positive population equals to k left arrow arbitrary such that lambda x is greater than zero. So k is something that is at greater than zero. It's a number. And then vector of k single population. This is what we are going to return. Two lines. So we are going to, we are picking an arbitrary number that is greater than zero, and then we are going to create a vector or a list that has a k elements, and each element is a single population. And what is single population? That's another generator. Single population has a type of gen planet population. So positive population has a generates a list of populations, and single population generates, as the name implies, just a single population. And it's written as a single population equals to let planet ID equals to SQL key 0, let arrays ID equals to SQL 0. So we are creating a database primary keys that are zeros for the planet ID and race ID. This is not touching to the database, we are just creating the primary keys values in the code. And then we are saying that population left arrow arbitrary such that lambda x is greater than zero. So again, we are picking a random number, that is arbitrary number that is more than zero. And then we are returning planet population, planet ID, race ID, population. So we are constructing planet population data that has three parameters, the planet and race IDs and population. Those planet and race IDs are primary keys. Foreign keys. They are referring to something, but we are not really dealing with the database here. We are just having values, and that's why we are setting them to the zero. And the population is that arbitrary number that is greater than zero. And these two functions work together. So when we are saying for all positive population, then the quick check, which is the testing tool we are using here, understands that it's going to call that positive population generator and generate some arbitrary positive population that has some arbitrary amount of planet populations that have arbitrary amount of population, I mean the inhabitants. And then it's going to check that it's going to call the food requirement and check that that is greater than zero for that arbitrary data that we just generated. And generators are, they can be really simple. They can be like just a single line if you want to just generate some arbitrary number that has some specific characteristic, like it's greater than zero or it's between 1 and 10 or depends on what you want to do. Or they can be really complex. Like if you had a space game and you wanted to test that galaxy has some specific properties, then you would have a generator that creates a galaxy that has stars, that has planets, that has people, and that has whatnot. And the more complex generators are often defined in a nested fashion. So you build up smaller generators that can generate some smaller amounts of data, and then you combine them to generate a bigger, more complex data. I like these a lot. They are quite a bit harder to write because you need to find that general property that you are going to test, and it's not always easy. Sometimes it's easy, and sometimes it's hard, and sometimes you feel that this is so obvious thing that doesn't make sense to test this at all. But why I like this is that it can check this test can check multiple cases of same kind. They might detect edge cases, or they can might detect performance problems. I had this actually once. I made a tiny change and in my code, and suddenly all tests relating to that part of the code started running really, really slow. All the quick check tests, those, because they were generating big data structures, and the change that I made decreased the performance a lot, you know, with the big data structures. So these ones helped me a lot. They take longer to run depending on your computer and depending on the tests, because for example that food requirement that I have been talking about with the default settings, the quick check is going to run it with 100 different inputs, so it's going to call that positive population generator 100 times, and it's going to check that for each of those times the property holds true. So it's going to generate 100 different test data and verify that with all these different cases this property still holds. 100 doesn't sound much, but when you have 100 tests and every one of them is run 100 of time, that's 10,000 tests suddenly. But that's how you might find some edge cases that are lurking there. And well, we basically just need something to test, then we need something to generate our test data and something to verify the result. So these aren't actually that complex in the end. They're just a bit more difficult to write than unit tests. So if you are starting to write tests, it might be a good idea to start with the unit tests. And when you get a feel of that, how that thing works and how you can do things there, then you can start doing these property-based tests and see how these compare to the unit tests. Or you can start directly from the property-based and then try the right unit test for the single specific cases that you want to cover. And of course, these have been just tests that work in isolation. They have a single function that they call with some data, and then they verify the output. The more sort of bigger, complex, different point of view looking tests are ones that are working with the database. And I have a database in the game, and there's some data, and I would like to verify that some things work with that too. So for those, again, it's a spec, but this time this time at the beginning of the spec, we are going to write with app and then describe status handling, describe planet statuses, then it expired planets, planet statuses are removed and new is created. And that with app is a function that there comes with the YESOD, and that does quite a bit of things. Like it initializes a test database, it automatically cleans the test database for you, and it even it even reads the configuration, and like you basically have a running system at that point. Your YESOD application, YESOD is that web framework I'm using, and Persistent is the database layer that I'm using. So it configures all that. So you basically have a fully running YESOD application that you can test. And in the this one I'm not going to read completely, but this test is expired planet statuses are removed and is created. So first we are using RunDB to insert some data. We are inserting a new star system. We are inserting a faction. This is the group of people working together. And then we are inserting a planet. And that faction we are inserting because that planet has our own owner. And that's a faction. And then we are inserting a planet status. We are going to say that this planet has a good harvest on a year. And we are setting the status expiration to 2020 January. And then we are setting the status of the application. We are inserting that. That's just, and saying that the year of the simulation is 2020 January. Okay, so we have a status that should be expire today. And then we are going to say that news, left arrow, run DB, remove expired statuses, simulation current time status. So we are going to call, we are calling remove expired statuses function with the current start date. And it will produce as a list of news that we are going to give hold of. Then they are kept in our news variable. Then we are just saying the statuses, left arrow, run DB, select list, planet status, planet ID equals to that planet ID that we created earlier. So we are loading statuses of that planet, and then we are loading all the news from the database. Loaded news, left arrow, run DB, select list, ask news date, so we are ordering them by the news date. So now we have the news that we created when we removed expired statuses. Then we have status, planet statuses after expired one has been hopefully removed. And then we have the news that we loaded from the database after we removed the expired statuses. And then we are just checking that statuses should satisfy lambda x, length x equals 0. So statuses should have a length of 0, news should have a length of 1, and loaded news should have a length of 1. So we are not, this is a bit loose test. We are just checking that when we remove the expired statuses, we got a one news article that probably is about that good harvest boost has ended. And we are checking that the news that we loaded from the database, that we have also the news about that good harvest boost ending, and then we should check that the statuses of the planet, is that there is no any statuses of the planet left, so that the one was removed. So we could make this a more specific by checking the actual values of those loaded items, but I'm not doing this. That, yeah, I'm sort of trusting that this is okay. Characteristics of these type of tests is that there are lots of things to write. I have to set up the system. I have to create the star system and the faction and the planet and the planet status and insert them into the database and set the simulation time to what I want. And so there's quite a bit of things to set up. And they are slower, even if in-memory database is used. And so, of course, when you are reaching, if you are reaching over the network to a database server and then writing and reading there, it's even slower. So it's a good idea to keep the database that you are using for these kinds of tests as close to your machine as possible. Preferably use a in-memory database that doesn't write into the disk, but otherwise works exactly the same as a database. They are more error-prone because we are doing input-output of here, so there's lots of things that can be wrong. Network can be down, there might be a communication error, there might be some glitch in the database, and setup might be a might leave the database in a funny state, or there might be some conflict somewhere, and all those things can break this test. And then when the test breaks, then you have to analyze that. Hey, is the problem in the code that I'm testing, or is the problem somewhere else? And is this a really problem, or is this that somebody just accidentally turned down the database server? That has happened too. But this can test parts that cannot be tested by the unit tests. So these are important things to test too. And the last thing I'm covering, this is already a half an hour episode. This is starting to get a bit long again. So the last thing I'm talking about is testing an API. So we have a in my game there's a REST API, so that you can just make HTTP request to load information and modify that information and tell the game what you wanna do and stuff like that. So I want to test those things too. And these specs start with add function. So we have a full ESR application up that we can test. So this one says that describe message handling to it authenticated use unauthenticated user can't access messages. And then it has _ left arrow get API message R. This is, we are going to do a HTTP get to the API message resource. This is our REST resource. And next line is status is 401. So we are going to do a HTTP request, and we are going to verify that we are getting a 401. So we are not authenticated. So we should not be getting any data back. The next one is it pending messages are loaded. So this one has a bit more. First we are going to call setup version that creates a person and faction for us. Then we are going to run db insert research completed 25250 faction ID high sensitivity sensors. So we are making a news entry about faction that we created completing research of high sensitivity sensors on a year 2525. Then we create a user called Pete. So create user Pete just person ID. So we are this creates a user named Pete. This is the actual user of the game or player of the game, and associate them with that person we created. That's their avatar. They are playing as that person. Then authenticate as user. So we authenticate Pete. And this authenticate as is a helper function provided by the Yesod that in development mode authenticates user. You cannot use that in a production code. There's a flag that when the application is compliant in the development mode, it enables this because this is basically a backdoor. So in the development mode, that's available. In a production code, it's not available. And you should, of course, trust it. You should verify that it's not in a production code. It's after deployment, it's not there. So we are authenticate as a user. Then we are calling the get AP message R. So we are going to do a HTTP get to that API message R resource. And then resp left arrow get response. So we are going to take the body of the response and hold it. And then we are going to do some parsing. JSON M equals join decode dollar diamond simple body dollar diamond resp. So we are our response, we are going to grab the body of the response and we are going to decode it as a JSON, and we are because now we have a nested maybe, so we are going to use join to squish them to the one maybe. So now we have a maybe value is a JSON value here, and then we are going to use some assert EQ message tag, and then there's a length again JSON M crave ?? just dot array dot head dot key tag dot string. So we are going to, of that JSON that we got as a body, we are expecting it to be array. We are going to take the first element of it, and we are expecting that to be a object, and then we are going to take the tag, key of tag, and that should have a value of string. And then we are comparing that to, it will be just research completed. So in our JSON structure, in this specific spot, there should be a research completed string. And then we are going to do the same with the start date. We are doing the assert EQ start date. JSON M crave ?? just array head key start date integer. So we are going to, again, we have an array. We are going to grab the first element of the array that we expect to be a JSON object. We are going to grab the start date value of it, and it should be an integer. And it should be just 25.25.0. That's the time we put in our research completed message. And then we are going to do one more assertion. Assert EQ technology. JSON M crave ?? just array head key contents key technology string. So again, array of JSON data. We are taking the first element from there. We are going to grab the content value from it. That is again object, and we are going to grab the technology value of that. That should have a string value associated with it, and it should be high sensitivity sensors. So we have three checks into the JSON content that we are checking. And then the last one is status is 200. So when we have authenticated user, we are loading the pending messages. We are asserting that the JSON content has three values that we are expecting to have. It might have some more, of course. We are only checking these three things, and then we are checking that our request has a resulted to a response with the HTTP status 200. That is means okay. And like with previous database tests, database is wiped automatically at the end of the test, or at the beginning. I'm actually not 100% sure when it does that. But the important thing is that when the test starts, it has a clean slate. It has a database that it can modify and it cannot mess with other tests. The database is always, you know, when the test starts, the database is always in a clean state. And you should be very careful not to accidentally run these against production. You should use your test database because of that wiping. You don't want to wipe your production database. Okay, characteristics of these API tests. There's a lot to write, again, because of the database setup. These are, again, slow and error-prone because we are doing I/O. Yeah. Reading and writing the database, you are doing HTTP requests. And these are really good because they actually test complete end-to-end. Like they start from the message comes to our system that we are testing. Message comes from the outside of the world into the system. And it goes through the software, reaches to the database, comes back to through the software, and goes back to the caller. So it's the whole end-to-end chain. And that's what the customer or user or whoever is calling is interested of. They're interested of that the whole thing works together. All the parts work combined together, works well. And this can also be, we were testing here that JSON stuff that the message returns, but of course we could test a generated HTML too. We could check that the HTML that was returned, if it were a resource that returns the HTML, we could test that it has some elements and some values there that we expect to be there. But I wouldn't, for example, I wouldn't want to test user interaction with this. Like if you wanted to test something that you have an application where user clicks around in the browser and then makes requests to the server and then comes back, I wouldn't use this for that. I would use something like robot framework for that, for example. Okay, so in closing, there's a lot of things that I didn't cover. This is only a 40-minute episode, so there's not enough time to cover much, but this is just a scratching the surface a little bit. We skipped UI testing, performance testing, security testing, long-running testing, and who knows what not, accessibility testing, and the list just goes on and on and on. We also didn't talk about formal proofs. That's something I have been reading about and trying to teach myself, which is really interesting because there you don't write tests to verify that your program is working correctly. You are just mathematically proving that your program is working correctly, which is completely different approach. So yeah, that's about it, Uncle. So the best way to reach me is either email or in the Fediverse, where I'm tuturto@mastodon.social. All questions, comments, and feedback are welcomed. Even cooler is if you decide to record your own Hacker Public Radio podcast. Talk to you later.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.